I wasn't quite 18, and I came on a university scholarship. It was also during the lockout that, you know, William Martin Murphy's business, and I went first of all to the women's suffrage movement. I wasn't of very much use because I was young. And
which branch did you go to? Was that the Irish Franchise League?
Yes, the yes, and there it was. There I met Mrs. Despard. But I could do very little for them except sell papers or stick up posters, you know. And in any case, there was nothing to the movement, nothing to it at all. It was then, as I tell you, it was the end, not the end, but part of the lockout, and people were starving in Dublin. Madame Markovich, you know, the Countess, started a soup kitchen in Liberty Hall, and I found my way down there, and I found some very good friends. Did you ever hear of Helena Maloney?
Yes, I come across her.
She was one of my best friends. Aymer, everybody called her.
There was also another, Dora Maloney as well, in the Irish.
Mm-hmm.
Have you come across Dora Maloney? Dora Maloney?
No, I didn't know any other Maloney except Aymer. That's, Madame McBride started a society called Inina Nahéireann, which means... Your ignorance.
I'm ignorant.
Yes, it means the Daughters of Ireland.
I see, yes.
And they all had Irish names. And none of these names stuck except Amers. And all that's Helena Maloney. And all her friends called her Amer always. She had been a Gaiety actress. And she had the most beautiful speaking voice that I've ever listened to. Really lovely.
Why did you come over to Ireland? Why did you join the suffrage movement in Ireland?
I was young and enthusiastic. And my mother used to talk to me about the Pankhursts. She was pro-Pankhurst, but very much against quite a lot of things that they did. But... here in Ireland, there was no such bird. Well, during that time, when Madame Markovich started the soup kitchen, we were all engaged in that. And all the time I was trying to do my studies, because I lost my scholarship if I didn't pass my exams. You know that.
What were you studying, Mr.
I studied the easiest thing, that's to say, English language and literature, you see, which...
Was that at Trinity College, or...?
No, I deliberately chose to go to the National. It was then fairly new, and I thought it might have some new ideas. God help my wit, it hadn't.
Well, you said you came over... Did you come over from England?
No.
Can you explain?
I'll have to tell you a long story.
Tell me a long story, yes.
Yes.
I'll put this small...
My father was a game warden. And he had a job as warden over thousands of acres up in the Wicklow Hills. An utterly beautiful spot. Well, when the first three of us were born, he decided that by some miracle or accident, he had produced an intelligent family. And he looked around and saw that there was no possibility of getting a good education up in the hills. So he took up his roots very reluctantly, because he was fond of Wicklow, and went down to the plains, went down to County Carlow, where he got a somewhat similar job, 400 head of Deer, that kind of a big place, you know. And then he looked around him for a place to get us educated. And he didn't like the kind of education that the Church of Ireland turned out. And he had a thing against co-education. Why, I don't know. But he found a little private convent school, and the fees weren't very great. So he took the three eldest girls. We were all girls.
He was a Catholic, was he?
No.
Wasn't he?
Not at all. Church of Ireland, if that means anything
yes,
to you.
It does, yes.
Yes.
And yet he sent his children to
yeah,
Catholic
he
school.
Did. I'll tell you now. He took us. He knew we were intelligent children. And this had a very good name, this convent school. He marched us in to the Reverend Mother and said, I wanted to teach my daughters. And the Reverend Mother said, it's most unusual to take anybody but Catholics, but I'll give them a test. And she gave us the test and took us in. It was very amusing in a way, because when we began to get scholarships and prizes and whatnot, because as I tell you, we were intelligent children. Other Church of Ireland children came along. And one day I met the head, a fine woman, Sister Catherine, smiling as she walked along the veranda. And I said, is the joke for anybody? And she said, yes, you know Frances Morton. I said, yes. She said, you know, she's just asked me, she said, Sister, are all Protestants good-looking? I said, what did you say? She said, I didn't say anything. What could I say? So I said, I'll tell you what you should have said. And you wouldn't have let your own side down or any other side. You should have said, well, they have to have some compensation for not being Catholics. Well, she said, that's I remember that again. I said, there won't be any again.
So you stayed at that school?
At that school, and
was
there I got, until I came up to Dublin with the university, because my eldest sister, who was brought up by a grandmother, the said grandmother, a very fine little rigid woman, half Calvinist, half Quaker, and she got decided she would be a missionary. So she got a scholarship for teaching. And they had a tag on that she had to stay 2 years in Ireland and teach 2 years before she went out in a missionary field. And the poor girl, when she had all finished all that, her training, her 2 years in Ireland, and they turned her down on health grounds. So she joined the, of all things, the Jewish Missionary Society. Try and convert a Jew, or even think about it.
She was very evangelical, was she?
She was religious.
Yes.
And in a way, none of us were. My father mostly brought us up. He was an unusual man, very, very handsome, 6 foot tall, jet black hair, and a lovely pale face, wonderful, wonderful features. Now, there's a tradition in our family, you know, it's a funny name, Ritster.
Yes, yes. Where does it come from?
It means, it's a Norse name. It means a dyer, not the kind that you have dying that you and I will have to do one of these days. Me sooner than you, but dyeing cloth. Mm. And there's a tradition that we stemmed from Geoffrey the Litster, if you've ever heard of him. He was a leader in the Peasants' Revolt.
I see, yes, yes. But why is your name Mrs. Litster? if your father was...
Yes, because David took my name by deed poll.
I see, yes.
I wouldn't use anybody else's name but my own. I was probably the first woman's libber.
So your husband was named...
Fagan.
I see, yes.
He was an engineer too. David's an engineer.
Mm.
He was an engineer in the Dublin Corporation.
So he took your name?
No, he didn't. No.
I see. You kept your own name.
Yes, I let people think what they liked.
Good for you.
Mm.
But tell me about your mother. Who is she?
She's Scott Wilson. And... It's her mother who was Calvinist plus Quaker, and my mother was a bit of a reaction, I think, because one day she pulled up her roots and eloped with my father.
But they were both Protestants then?
Oh, yes, yes. There was a very fine big photograph that hung up on our wall, and... It rather entertained us, because every time we asked who is so-and-so, who is so-and-so, we got no answer. The whole subject was changed. And it was only a couple of years after they were married that my father told me the story that they had eloped. And... my mother spent a good few days crying. She said she wasn't married because they were married in a registry office. And this, she had to have a photograph to send home to her mother. Otherwise, that's part of the tradition, I think. And this big photograph, the gentleman in the back with the beard, was the owner of the photography place. And the little woman beside him was his wife, and there were two daughters who were bridesmaids, but had no connection with us at all. Mm. And nobody said a word about it, just they turned the whole subject as soon as we asked who was this or who was that. Mm.
So you went to the National University...
Yes.
After you'd been educated. Yes. Did you live on your own in Dublin?
No, not at all. Where do you think I'd get the money?
Well.
I lived in a girls' friendly society hostel in Merrion Square. And I could study at night time in the National Library and get home about 10, you know. And during any spare time I had, I made soup and afterwards got tied up in the national movement.
Did you? So you got your degree then, did
yes.
you? Yes. In English?
English language and literature.
Yes. Mm. And then were you going to become a teacher?
Well, you just drift into that because there's nothing else to do, but I didn't actually. There were, at this time, things were getting very hot and we were trying to get rid of the English administration. Now, you must forget all the, if it hurts your feelings, all that I say about it. And what I could do and did do with about half a dozen men was to get the different local authorities to pay their rates and taxes and all the rest of it into the Sinn Féin and not into the castle, you see?
I understand, yes.
You had to be very quiet. You kept what the soldiers, I think, call a low profile, because you were jailed, of course, if you were caught. Anyhow, that's what I did during the movement, the whole trouble. Until
when you qualified, what did you do for a living?
For about a year or two, I taught. During one part of it, I had to. There was a man an IRA man, you see. He had been in the 16 in the Rising. And his doctor came to me and said to me, I want you to take Gerard Crofts out of the country because if he gets another spell in jail, he'll die. And I thought to myself, this was very funny because the man had a wife and a brother. However, that was that. And I had two brothers who had joined the British Army and were in the First War, you know. And one of them, the elder of them, gave me a loan of his papers, discharge papers. So I took this IRA man and the papers and got a job in a Wesleyan Methodist school in Southport.
Is that Southport, England?
Yes, Southport, England, and took the man over there. It nearly killed me. I got a taxi and had him in it. And when we were on the way to the boat, I was watching through the mirror at the time, and I saw a lorry of soldiers come up behind us. And I said nothing at all about it. But just as we came up to the boat, the entry of the boat, it slid past us and drew in front of us. I thought, I'm finished now. I thought that this man was on the run. They were looking for him. So I didn't say anything to him, only just come out because I had to get the tickets. So I went and got the tickets and we were searched. Got into the boat all right. I couldn't have chosen a better day because Lord Rugby, I think his name was over and going back on that boat, and they weren't looking for wanted men at all. They were looking for arms, you see. So, but it was the only time in my life I'd been sick, and I was sick all the night. However, I got him over and got digs for him and took up the job. Now, people are very funny. I'll tell you something about... I had a young man at the time that I was very fond of. And he of me, I think. But there's one thing on my conscience, and it will never come off it. I encouraged him to risk his life, and he lost it, and I didn't. Well, all the time that I was in England, he was picked up, and he was in a concentration camp, Ballykinlar, in the north of Ireland. And I used to send him papers and books and write to him, and I thought it was unwise to do that somebody in the post office would notice things going over there and decide there was somebody maybe worth picking up in Southport. And he died, and I hadn't sent him a postcard for months.
He was an Irishman, was he?
Oh, of course he was. A very nice chap, but he died.
But the Irishman you brought over, he stayed in Southport, did he?
He stayed in Southport.
Yes.
And I blamed him illogically for the conditions in which I had to ignore the other lad. But I had to buy food for him. And occasionally the landlady would do things for me. So I remember saying to her one day, Mrs. Prohl, that was, where does that name come from? Prohl, P-R-O-L-E. We had a woman here called Maura Proles, P-E-R-O-L-Z, who was just invaluable to the movement because she had a photographic memory. Nobody had to write her down any message. They just told her what they wanted and she went and repeated it. Mm-hmm. However, this man that I had taken over to Southport, I looked over after, he came back as soon as the truce came along. And sometime after he was back, he came to see me. I had a flat. He came to see me and said to me, "Would you mind not mentioning that I was over in Southport with you?" Now, do you see why?
Well, did he...
He was taking refuge in the enemy's country.
I see, yes.
So I held my tongue. But there you are.
But how long did you stay in Southport?
About 2 months, perhaps.
And then you came back.
Came back here and
still teaching. Were you teaching still?
Oh no! I went into the so-called civil service.
You mean the IRA or the?
The Sinn Féin civil service. Yes.
Did you really? So you were right in the thick of things.
Yes, and for years. Because after the split came, the government here, that's to say the provisional government, did what I thought was a dreadful thing to do. But they did it perhaps for reasons of economy, I don't know. They kept on a good number of the key men in the civil service. It was a dangerous thing to do because quite obviously, I thought, these men weren't quite suddenly going to change their allegiance from one side to the other. And if they came across something in their work that they thought would be of interest to the English authorities, well, over it would go. One man was sacked, I know, for that.
Was he really?
Yes. They're making the same mistake today here.
So you were paid by this Sinn Féin, were you?
No.
As a worker?
Well, at first we had to do a good deal for nothing, you see. And then after that they gradually gave you something. But it wasn't a terrible lot, I may tell you. They hadn't very much money.
No.
Just what Mick Collins could collect.
So then, what did you do later on in your life then? How did things work
out?
Well,
I stayed on in the civil service. And my holidays, I spent bringing Madame McBride, Helena Maloney, and various other people round to canvass for Sinn Féin. Now, I must tell you, there was one reason why I tell you that there was no such word as suffrage here.
Yes, tell me, yes.
Women's suffrage. You go to a door and knock at it. 9 times out of 10, the woman of the house would open it. And you'd start your sales talk. And 9 times out of 10, you got the same reply. I've got to wait. Sure, I must wait till himself comes home. Now, that still exists.
So, really, you're saying that the traditional attitudes to woman's function in the
yes.
family are very strong in Ireland.
What they call the men must be asked. There was a hotel we used to go to, my husband and I, up in Cross Malina. And the woman of the house, when we went the first time there, we were starved. And there was a big saddle of mutton ready there, steaming and ready to be cut. So I said, "Look, we'll start without waiting for the men." "Oh, but But you must ask, you must wait for them in. We weren't even allowed to choose which bedroom we'd take. Must ask them in. And that still exists in a large part of Ireland. But I think with a bit of luck, it's stopped. Now there's the... So of course, the church didn't like it.
The Catholic Church, you mean?
Catholic Church, yeah. Yes. Mm. Do you think there's any other here? When I went over to New Zealand for a bit, I mentioned one time we were talking out there, I mentioned the Church of Ireland, and someone said, oh, you mean the Roman Catholic Church? I said, I don't. But you must. That is the Irish Church. And they would hardly believe me.
But the Catholic Church has a very conservative attitude to the position of women, doesn't it? And was that a major hindrance? To the whole women's movement
Is it so in England?
Yes, I mean, but it's much less important in English society, of course, the Catholic Church.
Yes,
but
I think with a bit of help.
Were most of the suffrage people before the First War, were they mostly Protestants then?
Well, Mrs. Despard was, of course, and... Madame McBride and Constance Markovitch. Mm. Most of them were. Mm.
And you were?
I'm nothing and never haven't been for a long
time. But I mean, you may be representative. I just really wondered how representative you think you were in the Irish woman's movement, in being Protestant.
The Protestants here have been wrongly tagged with being anti-national. There were five men, friends of mine, who were Church of Ireland and North of Ireland and were in the Rising. Mm. Now, they were doctrinaire Republicans and very fine men.
Because there's another problem about women's movement here.
Yes, the problem is the church and the Bible, where the man has to be head of the... that the other thing? Do you know I heard a piece of logic the other day that will astound you? No.
Were you a student when you joined the women's movement in Dublin?
Serious?
Hmm.
Yes, but the state of the poor people in Dublin, and then the Republican movement on top of that, had to push everything out of the way. Mm. That's why.
So you
there
just
wasn't.
You started off in the
started
women's
off in the women's suffrage and
then you went on
and then went into republicanism.
Mm. What did you do in the suffrage movement? What did you do for them?
As I told you, when I went, I wasn't quite 18.
Mm. So you were selling newspapers, were you?
Selling newspapers and putting up posters and all that kind of thing. But there was very little I could do. Mm. Then just plunged straight into republicanism, and I never got out of it.
So did your women's experience influence you in favour of republicanism? Is there a connection between the two, do you think?
I doubt it. I doubt if it had any effect at all.
I mean, you were a rebel by joining the women's movement. Does that make you a rebel in the other sphere as well?
I think if you're born a rebel, you can't help it. Mm. Just, that's that.
Mm. Mm. But one of the problems for the women's movement in Ireland is that it's cut right across by this nationalist or Republican versus English thing.
Not even cut across it, it was cut into little pieces.
Mm. Mm. And it takes a long time to grow out of that.
Well, I think it's beginning. Mm. I have a hope. That, say, now, if the Fianna Fáil government stands by their word and puts some women at least into positions of power. If this, if that, you could write that with a big I and a big A, bigger F. That they may get somewhere. But the only woman that I've any confidence in, and she wasn't elected, is Mary Robinson.
Did you become active in the women's movement after independence? Or there just wasn't a women's movement?
There wasn't any such thing. There was no such animal. And there isn't any such animal yet. Women have got to begin from the
bottom.
From A, yes, A, B, C, and work up.
So really, you spent your career inside the Republican movement.
Inside the Republican movement.
As what you call a civil servant.
Yes.
And then you got married then, did you?
Well, there was a rule against... Now, keep this to yourself. There was a rule against women marrying in the civil service at that time. There isn't now. But when I... To tell you the truth, I didn't marry pour le bon motif. I wanted a bigger house because I had a lot of lame ducks that had to be... There was no slots, that's what you call mixed metaphors. There was no slots that I could fix these people in, and I wanted a bigger house. And I didn't have any shortage of offers. But I told the minister at the time. He was fortunately a man who had been at college with me. I told him what I wanted, and he said, "Well, we don't want to lose you, but all I'm telling you is I don't want to know anything at all about it, but don't raise any scandals." Well, I didn't mean that scandal to be raised. However, it happened.
But so you married to help the movement in a way, did you?
All the time I spent my holidays or took leave whenever it was necessary to go to elections and do canvassing and all that sort of thing for Sinn Féin. But I wasn't engaged in any suffrage work because there was no such work.
Did you try and influence Sinn Féin in favour of women at all?
Oh, yes. But you came all the time up against the church and against the I must ask himself. It's a terrible proposition here.
So, then you stayed in the civil service until you retired, did you?
Yes, until I retired, yes.
What part of the civil service were you in?
In the Department of Health. And I had for a long while the charge of unmarried mothers and their children. That's what I wanted the bigger house for. I worked with the Council for the Unmarried Mother and Her Child, if you know it at
Mrs.
all.
Mrs. Fisher's organisation, yes.
And we were careful in writing. You see, at that time, the Brits didn't want a mouth with a pair of useless hands. And if they got a pregnant woman from Ireland, shove her out. So the Council for the Unmarried Mother and Her Child and I, we kept constantly back and forwards, you see, and we were very careful not to use any headed notepaper in case it would fall into the wrong hands. Now, I was asked, since I came back here, to go on television, and I refused. David was furious. But he didn't understand. This is a very small country. If you mention an episode that can be traced back, they'll trace it back and back and back and back until they get thing. I'll give you one example. There was a girl who came over with a baby, and the Catholic Protection and Rescue Society, with whom I worked a good deal, we had arranged an adoption for this baby. And she signed the papers and all the rest of it. And then she said she'd go home for a few days. So she went home. And I thought that was the end of it. Until one morning there was a knock at my door. And Christy, the messenger, came in with a big sergeant. He said he wants to see Miss Lister. That was me. So I said, what can I do for you? And he said, well, we've just lifted a girl out of the river. And she has an envelope in her pocket addressed to you. And we want to know who she is and all about her. Well, I told more lies in 5 minutes than I told in my whole previous life, I think. It was the girl, of course, but it was a foggy morning. And the sergeant asked me, would I go down and identify her? And I did. And then I had to think very rapidly. And when he'd gone, I had to go and see the coroner, because it would be obvious to him when he was doing a post-mortem that she'd had a baby, and got his promised him a lot of things if he'd hold his tongue. So he held his tongue. Well, now, if anything of that came out wouldn't somebody say, well, do you remember the time that Maggie Moriarty came home for the weekend? Yes. You see, so I couldn't afford to have questions asked me, so I said I wouldn't go on television.
So really, in a way, you've been working for women in an underground sort of way.
Underground all the time.
All the time. Mm. But there's no possibility of an overground movement until recently, really.
I hope that there may be something come out of this Fianna Fáil movement. I don't know. I doubt it.
What politically then? Did you attach yourself to Fianna Fáil or what?
No, I didn't. As a matter of fact, I always had a few doubts in the back of my mind about Dave. But for Sinn Féin was all we worked.
Mm.
And James Connolly. I'm a socialist still.
I see, yes. Yes. So the continuous thread in your life is partly social work, isn't it?
It's part of the social work. James Connolly too has fallen into disrepute. They started some Connolly clubs here, and the clergy got them, knocked a lot of them, nearly burned out. Because they were Connolly, James Connolly was tagged with socialism, which they think is atheistic, communistic. Mm.
What did your parents think about your joining the women's movement when you joined?
My parents were, you couldn't meet people like them ever. When I got my degree, he wanted me to do medicine, but I wanted to get out and earn, because my people had made great sacrifices to educate 7 of us. And they were the most generous people, and they trained me to think for myself. I'll give you an example of it. The first child boy he had. We called him Boy because he was the only boy we knew. But my eldest sister, who was brought up by my grandmother, was wheeling him in a, what she called a go-cart, I would call it a wheelchair, at the side of the river. And it slipped, and the boy went in, the wheelchair and all. She was brought up to look for authority. And she ran home screaming, but I jumped into the water and held the wheelchair with one hand and a bush by the other, so that, except that we were very wet and very cold, nothing happened to us. Now that will, I think, is proof of the difference that bringing environment and
yes.
actual...
But the same birth,
yeah, the same
family,
birth,
but different upbringing.
Yes, yes. Mm.
Did you had how many brothers and sisters did you have?
Two brothers and four sisters.
And did the sisters go into the women's movement?
No,
at
they
all?
Didn't. Mm. No. I think I'm probably the only was probably the only rebel in the family. But though I had my youngest brother Jack, he's still alive. He's 77 this year, same as the century. He joined the British Army when he was just 15 years old. He was a big lad and he said he was 18. And when the war was over, he tried to get out of it. And he found that the sergeant who had signed him on.
Recruited him, yes.
Got more when they signed a man on to the strength, as they called it,
yes.
than for the war, simply for the war. Mm. So he found he was stuck. He couldn't get out of it. And he told the colonel that he didn't care what he was getting out of the army he wasn't sticking in. And the colonel came to him a couple of days after and said, Lidster, I can get you out, but it won't be nice. And Jack said, I don't care if you drum me out of the army. He said, I'm not staying in it. And do you know what was on his discharge papers? You know, it's incredible. Reason for discharge, a sensitive Sinn Féiner. That didn't do him any good in the north of Ireland. But, you see, my elder brother, he hadn't any compromising papers of that kind. It was he that lent me his discharge papers to get the Sinn Féiner over. Now, you see, they were in sympathy with a lot of things.
That's interesting. You said your mother was sympathetic to the
women's
movement.
Oh, yes, both of them. There was one day, there was a big battle going on behind our house across the river. You could hear the guns going off. And Dad came round and he saw my mother buying up the contents of a bread van, filling it into her apron. And he said, what are you going to do with all the bread? She said, these fellows on the other side of the river, they're bound to be beaten. And there's only one way out for them and they're beaten, that's down that lane. Well, there's no one going past my door hungry. And she wasn't pro Sinn Féin. She was, you know, true blue, I suppose, anything you call her. But they wouldn't hurt my feelings or anyone's feelings that had other opinions. We lived for, as Linklater, I told Linklater, he wrote when he wrote to me, beside Mrs. Despard for a long while. Well, the This is, by the way, St. Billy's Day. Did you not remember that?
If you do, were they mostly university women in the women's movement here?
In the suffrage movement?
In the suffrage movement, yes. Because you were a university woman. I wondered whether other people were as well.
No, I don't think so.
Mm.
They were just far-sighted women, you know.
Mm.
Or maybe women who looked into things and saw mm. that they had no power whatsoever.
Mm. Mm.
You know, I was just talking to somebody the other day about the marriage laws here. Look, ask Linklater. He's writing a biographer offer.
He is. Where did you meet her?
She was the quaintest little woman you ever came across. Not very likeable. And she'd ask you over to tea, or you'd ask her over to tea, and she'd sit there, and you'd sit there, and by the time she'd finished with you, you were like a squeezed orange. She was a vampire.
Was she really? In what way? And what was she squeezing out of you?
She'd squeeze all the information that she could out of you, and in such a way that she got it out. But she lived beside us, as I tell you, in the north of Ireland, in Belfast. And I have a recollection of one day, because today is the same day, St. Billy of Orange. And on that day, in the north of Ireland, all the Union Jacks and the Orange flags are all out. And Dad, who wouldn't hurt our feelings, or any feeling at all, he said he didn't put out any flag. And then Mrs. Despard hadn't one out. So I sat there waiting for the stones to be coming through the window, and there were no stones. And when it was all over, I jumped over the hedge between the two houses, and I went into the old lady. And what do you think was the first thing I saw? A large portrait of Lord French, who was our brother. Well, we didn't have any Lord Frenches or any other lords in our family, but I think maybe his wing was stretched over as far as we are concerned.
Mm.
She was an extraordinary woman because she was a suffragist first. And then she became a communist. And she became a Republican. And towards the end of her days, she became a Catholic.
Did she really?
Mm.
Yeah, did she? Where were you living when you were next door neighbours? Whereabouts?
Up in the north, in Belfast. And I was only up there because the north of Ireland, because of the St. Billy's Day coming in, you see,
mm.
in the middle, because... there's nearly always trouble, and we were living a place which Dad always called Overlooking Stormont. Actually, Stormont went up and up and up opposite us, so that they were overlooking us. But they were living. Dad and Mother were living up there at the time, but Mrs. Despard, Charlotte Despard, was beside us. She was a quaint little woman, you know.
She looked rather striking with her mantilla, didn't she?
And yeah, she wore a black lace mantilla all the time. But you should have seen Madame McBride. Madame McBride was 6 foot tall.
Mm.
And she wore black long skirts and a veil. And she had two large wolfhounds that walked with her. And people used to turn and look at her because she was not only striking, but she was beautiful.
Mm.
Absolutely beautiful to the end of her days.
How old was Mrs. Despard when you knew her?
Well, she was 90.
Yeah.
And there was, as I tell you, a small hedge between the houses.
Mm.
And we were leaving it. and leaving our outhouse. And Dad was a very, very good vegetable man. And he was about 70 at this time. And he went over to see the old lady to say goodbye. And she was getting, I think she was nearly 92 at the time, I'm not sure. Now he said, "Mrs. Despard, I'm leaving some potatoes and onions and rhubarb and all cabbage over there. Anytime you want anything, just jump over the hedge." So there you are.
A 92-year-old jumping over the hedge.
She was a remarkable woman in many ways.
She was. In a lot of ways she was remarkable. But as I tell you, she was a vampire.
She just sucked you dry, you felt. She sucked you dry when she talked to you.
If she wanted information, she got it. Mm. And she stayed at you, hammered at you until she did get it.
Mm. What did she do with the information, Dan? What did she do with the information?
I think that she stored it mainly. But she told me one time, though, that she, when Madam McBride had been in jail for a bit, and she was on hunger strike, and she said, "I started her with a little soup," and she told me exactly how she made the soup. I didn't care tuppence if she'd made it on arsenic or anything. But she was good too, in that sort of way, you know, kindly.
Well, she certainly had an open mind if she went from... She had an open mind. She changed her colour.
All the things that she belonged to. And she belonged to Shaw's Fabian Society.
Yeah, she was a vegetarian, I think, as well.
Yeah, she's a vegetarian too. Yes. You know the sad thing about Shaw and the vegetarianism?
No.
He got anemia very badly.
Mm.
And his doctor very wisely insisted upon his having liver injections and threw him out of the Vegetarian Society.
Really? Mm. That's pretty rough, isn't it?
Then he wrote a book, a lovely little book called The Black Girl in Search of God.
Yes. Mm.
With beautiful illustrations.
Mm.
And the Beekeeper Society in Wexford threw him out of that society too.
And didn't the Bishop of Galway have them burned? Wasn't that the book that was burned publicly?
Yes.
And there was a caretaker in it called Moore. He lived down some winding stone steps down below, and he had books and books and books. And I got to know him. And he lent me books. So this particular day I remember well, because he had given me a big volume of Ben Jonson's Masks, and I was hugging it to myself. I was a very thin young one at the time, when he suddenly said to me, "Get out of this," he said, "here's Mr. Shaw." But that didn't mean anything to me, but I looked up and I thought he was miles high. He was, he wasn't such a tall man at all, but he was all in black with his forked beard. And he was up at the top of the steps, and I went in against the side of the wall and still hugging my Ben Jonson, you see, and passed him. That's the one and only time I ever met him.
Mm. Mm. Did you, were there any really impressive women in the suffrage movement when you joined it who attracted you to it? I mean, who were the big women in Dublin in the suffrage when you joined?
The first one I met was Mrs. Despard.
She was the first
one?
Yeah,
there. Okay. And then after that I met Helena Maloney, whom I hugged to my bosom till the end of my days. Her days, not mine.
But which one attracted you into the movement? Who influenced you to join it?
I think Mrs. Misha.
Just yourself?
Yes, myself. Do you know that word, Misha?
No.
It's the Irish for myself. Misha Fain.
And what made you go to the first meeting you went to?
To the
first suffrage meeting you went to. Why did you go?
Could you answer that one, Joe? You do the same.
Just pure interest you'd go for.
Just you felt interested.
Also, the utterly appalling conditions that the Dublin poor were living in at the time.
Mm.
I think every young person has that generous instinct to help people that are young. Mm. Fortunately or unfortunately, we lose it later on. And the young people nowadays haven't got it at all, have they?
No, there was a survey done on it recently and it's saying that young people are less responsive to the agonies of the poor than the older people, that they don't care at all. Yes, I just read that recently in the paper.
That's in Ireland, is it?
I'm not sure if it was Ireland or England. I read the report
about it. Surprises me. Mm. But do you think in your own life, your suffrage, the few months you were in the suffrage period, were influential, were important really? Or were they just a brief moment that didn't lead to anything?
That's when I went to the suffrage.
Mm.
No, I went on purpose looking for something.
But did it achieve anything though, in the long term? Did the movement, such as it was, achieve anything?
No, nothing whatsoever.
But did it influence your life, you, in your life?
No,
much?
It didn't at all. It would. I would have liked to influence it, but
I mean, it didn't get you launched in politics or get you speaking or anything like that.
I got to politics straight off, plunged in.
That's interesting because you know sometimes
she was a charming woman, really. It was a dreadful business, that, wasn't it?
Oh, shocking.
Yes.
It was all an accident, as far as I can see.
Yes, her sister, Mrs. Kettle, too, they were both very delightful women.
Mm.
And if Hannah had remained in Ireland instead of trotting around the world as she did after he was murdered, perhaps she might have done something for it, I think. She was a very intelligent woman, a woman who said what she thought and did what she thought right, like he did, as he, you know, he was a...
Oh, yes, uncompromising person.
Oh, no, he wasn't a Republican.
No, they killed the wrong man, didn't they?
Well, I think Colthurst, the British officer that shot him, was as mad as a hatter, of course.
Yeah.
He shot three very good men as well, lined them up as at the barrack wall. But I don't think they did refer him to a medical man, and he was declared insane. But strangely enough, the insanity vanished in a very short time.
Did it really? I see. You mean he was let out, you mean?
Was let out.
Yes.
He was, do you know what she Skeffington was doing when he was shot?
He was trying to organise anti-looting,
yes, trying to stop the people from looting. That's the kind of man he was. If he saw anybody doing anything that they shouldn't have been doing, well, he tried to stop it.
Did you join the Irish Women's Franchise League, or was it the WSPU that you joined?
No, the Franchise League, I think. I don't, that's not...
You're not sure, but
not,
you think...
Straight from the horse's mouth. I don't know, but oh, they were a great loss to the country, the pair of them, and Mrs. Kettle.
Did you sell the Irish Citizen in the streets when you were selling papers? Which paper was it you sold?
I'm daft if I know. I've just handed them and I went and handed them, you know. You went to a church door, if you like, you see, and handed them out there. But I hadn't an awful lot of time. I had to study.
So you just did it occasionally?
Occasionally, as I could manage. Do you know where I got a lot of my education?
No.
Coming home from the National Library at 10 o'clock at night, there was an old chap sitting in one of those huts. He was with a brazier, you know. You know the kind of man.
Warm your hands.
Yes, yeah, but he had a job. He had to look at her. And I used to go in and sit beside him. He'd give me a cup of tea, or I'd give him whatever I had, biscuits or anything like that. He'd been all over the world in the British Army. And he told me a grand lot of stories, and I got a great deal of my education from him.
You seem to have been a very intelligent girl. You were.
Me?
Yes, you were hunting for knowledge everywhere, from the bookseller and from your father and from, you know, the watchman and from everybody.
Well, nobody ever can assess themselves, you know, and there's no use asking me what kind I was.
Mm.
You make life for yourself as it is, you know.
Mm. Mm. But you were seizing opportunities everywhere, as far as I know.
Ah, yes.
Mm.
When I was in the civil service, I was representing the woman representative on the Association of Professional Women, Professional Civil Servants. I was the only woman on it. The time came when the women in the civil service decided that they weren't being properly treated and they wanted equal rights with the men. So we organized a protest march, and the president of the society in which I represented the women stood up on his hind legs. He must have heard about this, and he said, "I want to read Miss Lutzka something, a paragraph that occurs in our constitution, which gave them the right to summarily eject any person who acted in a manner that they considered wasn't the correct way." So I had no banner to march under. There was only Misha Fain. So I got a convenient policeman and walked along with him. And the next meeting, Dr. Wendt said, "Miss Lester, did you march in that procession?" And I said, "Yes, Dr. Wendt, I did." There wasn't another word said about it. That night, it was about, I think, 12:30 when the meeting ended, two or three men came down the stairs after me and said, "Don't worry your head about that. We're behind you. We'd have to vote on it. You needn't worry." I said, "I didn't happen to notice you at the protest meeting." That was, now that's Ireland.
Well, on that note,